show do you do?
It's called Polycast.
On the internet, is it?
So much power at one's fingertips.
It's amazing the attraction of this game.
You mean none of this was real?
Welcome to episode 17 of Polycast, the official podcast of Apollotan Civilization site. I'm Wouter, known as Locutus on the forums, and I'm here with Dan.
I know a bot, her name is Anna, and there is her name. Hi, she can ban you so hard.
Oh,
there you go.
Key.
Okay.
Don't quit your day job.
Moving along. With us here is also, of course, Maki.
Hello.
And Imran is not here because we silenced him.
Not before time.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not permanently, though. Nobody call the authorities. Okay.
Not yet. We'll get there. We'll get there. Sadly, we have two guest hosts for this week. The first one is Provost Harrison.
Hello there.
And Snoopy 369.
Hello.
I'm assuming that everybody knows everybody here, but that could be wrong.
I think I know everyone.
I wasn't talking to you.
As well as I'd like to.
I like lists. Mackie will know this very well.
Mm-hmm.
Mackie's thinking, uh-oh.
Uh-huh.
Twists on Civ 4 quotes, where you were to twist the quotes of any leader or saying in Civ 4 to suit a Civ series purpose. From Lanku, when I give food to the poor, they call me a saint. When I ask why the poor have no food, they tell me it's because we're building a worker.
Yes.
Gaius Octavius, never trust an Aztec you can't throw out a window. So true.
Truly.
Styles JL, he started this thread. Beep, beep, beep you. That's not nice.
A game directed at Monty, I presume.
Who put a recorder in the room when I was playing Civ?
From Night Owl, what gunpowder did for war, Blake did to the AI.
Oh, it's true.
From Weasel 77066, the master is greater than the sum of his vassals. And here's a great username, Wooly Wool Wine 83. Ooh, say that three times fast. Never bring a sword to a gunfight, but always bring a gun to a sword fight.
And we're unofficially changing the name of the modcast for the next couple of months to Beyond the Swordcast.
Ah, yes.
We'll have to go through this time.
Maybe for episode 18, we'll have a quiet week.
Not until after Beyond the Sword.
And then maybe we'll run out of Civ stuff to talk about. Mackie.
It could happen.
In the news, we talk about more Beyond the Sword news. Alex Manzares was interviewed again, and we have news on the scenarios that ship with the game. We also have some Civ 3 news. The Canada mod was released.
Woo-hoo!
And then it's going on and on and on and on and on. About
on and on and on. Then I woke up again, and then I fell back to sleep again.
Yeah. And we have a quick news item about a mod-making competition for Civ 4 and Warlords. So guess who's going to do the modcast?
This week's modcast, we talked about is Beyond the Sword of Trail, Soren's original vision for the game. And what other things might bother you about Civ 4? On the resources, we talked about what was most and least important sources. And
that last segment leads us into our latest research lab segment, the question of quantitative resources.
This week in the Senate, we talked about what to do with those great generals you generate, with some of our worst starts ever, particularly starts where you don't have any room and you start next to somebody else, how to win a cultural victory,
plus what type of victory we typically go for and why,
and what's a very good city and specialized or not specialized.
I just found it interesting that you would compare Warlords with Play the World.
I never bought Play the World. There was nothing meaningful that I liked that it added, whereas Bot Conquest, and I liked it quite a lot. To me, Warlords added particularly interesting new stuff that Play the World, other than adding multiplayer, I don't see the comparison there at all.
Play TM Sam Gibson interviews Alex Manzares. He's the lead designer and programmer on the Civilization IV expansion Beyond the Sword, in case anybody didn't know. The byline of this write-up talks about Gibson probing for Axis, but we really shouldn't say that here, since this is a family-friendly show. So, what did we find out?
Well, I guess it confirmed how Warlords will tie in with Beyond Sword. And the scenarios from Warlords will not be there, but the core functionality, so the great generals and stuff like that, will be in Beyond Sword. A lot of people were wondering about that. So I guess that's good news.
Yeah, I guess it's not really surprising. We had kind of a precedent set with Civilization III Conquest and Play the World.
That's true. Still, a lot of people were wondering about that, so good to see it confirmed.
I remember having this discussion on the bulletin board, and it seemed an odd point. I mean, I remember this even as far back as Civ 3, where they added the previous functionality. You don't get any of the other bells and whistles, but in terms of the core changes, all those go through.
Yeah, it would have been very strange if they hadn't done that.
Yeah, it would also be really hard to develop that. Somehow make it work both for Warlords and for the regular game only.
Do you have some info on the corporations as well, and some idea of how they work? I've seen a few hints towards what goes on with these things before. I'm just curious what he means by a maintenance fee. How expensive are they to have?
We discussed corporations in episode 16 a little bit, although I don't think we talked about the maintenance aspect.
Yes, I think that's the only new thing I can recognize that it says there.
Mercantilism blocking foreign corporations. I don't know about anybody else, but I really had no use for mercantilism at any time before, though I suppose if you believe or know you're going to be isolated from other civs for an extended period of time, you might want to give it a try, but now perhaps with the blocking of foreign corporations, they may come into greater use.
Yes, it'll keep them from spying on you and getting money from you while you're building up your armies to go take them out.
Yeah, there were a decent number of single-player games I had that I'd use mercantilism just because there was no reason not to. Because nobody else would trade with me anyway, because I made them all mad.
You know, killing people, have you? It is the only time I use it. If you've got some very lucrative trade routes, you don't want to shut them all down.
Right.
Yeah, but if the other trade routes you can get with the other civilizations aren't as good as what you can get within your own empire, then it's great.
Very true. I've never seen that happen before, though, mind you.
Yeah, every once in a while. Or in the case of going to war, and you know you're about to lose the trade routes anyway.
Right.
So no new resources.
Yep.
The foreign advisory screen is getting an overhaul.
I would presume some of the overhaul could come as a result of espionage.
If you get that your espionage sense. Details on the same screen, that would make sense.
Yep.
Added considerable content to the modern era, new modern technologies. Lasers, superconductors, stealth.
Oh yeah, and there were some new buildings names. Things like levees. And
transportation, industrial parks. New modern units, mobile SAM, mobile artillery, tactical nuke, tac submarine, missile cruiser, and stealth destroyer. Ooh.
That sounds dangerous, doesn't it?
It sure does.
And the Cristo Redentor wonder allows you to switch civics without anarchy. This has been interesting because that means it would act like the, or at least the most interesting part of the spiritual trait.
Yeah, that really doesn't interest me, but I don't really play with the spiritual trait that much, so.
Oh, you must.
He doesn't need it on Dan level.
And now you've got to get your spaceship to Alpha Centauri rather than just send it there.
The AI launches before you, then you can catch up to them. And I noticed also you can customize it too. I mean, the appearance.
Ooh, make it more shiny.
Yeah.
And I guess the AI has gotten considerably better at its previous major weaknesses, which was conducting military operations, especially naval invasions. Really?
Believe that when I see it.
Yeah, they do say that every time, so.
It is even stronger at managing its economy, and it also knows how to use all the new features that were added. Well, there goes my new strategy. And speaking of shiny, the graphics are more polished.
Should be interesting to see what that involves, what exactly they're going to change about the graphics. They'll probably be very subtle.
I guess there'll be new world types and some new game options, such as the option to play as any leader civilization combination, which we talked about before. And it's optional. The option to trade away technology only if you have researched it yourself.
That's going to make a lot of the people who play Diplo games happy. I know they play with that voluntarily.
Yeah, this was clearly aimed at them.
And the option to actually choose the religion you found when you discover technology. All right.
Oh, finally.
That's quite interesting. That at least you won't always get Judaism or Hinduism dominating. You might actually get Islam, which usually tends to be banished to a distant corner of the world.
Yeah, and Taoism, too.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I guess for those who play multiplayer, whatever that is, in multiplayer games, now all players on the same team can take their turns simultaneously.
the problem with simultaneous turns, especially for those of us who play PTBS or Pit Boss games, is the simultaneous turns leads to a lot of abuses when someone at the end of the turn then takes another turn. So we'd rather play with synchronous turns, but then, of course, the game just takes forever. So I guess that sounds sort of like a compromise.
And in Hot Seat, some people still play Hot Seat. What? You see the movement of any AI players that take their turn between the last human player and you. Oh, yes, I got the scenario list in front of me. Some of these we've talked about before. Do we need to talk about Final Frontier? Probably not.
Nope. Broken Star sounds interesting. Still don't know how that's actually going to play out in the game. The divided Russia. It's either purchase military units from the U.S. or upgrades from the Chinese black market. Or just blow everything up. Oh, they're including Fall from Heaven and Rise and Fall?
Yep, it's two fan mods in there. Fall from Heaven, the fantasy mod by... Kyle or Kel or whatever you're supposed to pronounce that name. Is that probably the most popular mod for Civ 4 out there? So no surprise really that those guys got included in Beyond the Sword. And the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. It's also a pretty popular mod.
Rise and Fall is hard. I played the Warlords one, I don't know, 3 or 4 times, and I can't get anywhere near winning in it.
Well, that sounds good to me. Most of the scenarios that ship with the Warlords and the regular game are way too easy to win, so it'd be nice to have something that's actually a challenge for a change.
Gods of old create a legion of religious zealots by demonstrating your greatness or by forcing their religion down everyone's throat. Isn't that a strategy?
Yeah, I think it's how most people play.
Yeah. Nothing new there. So we have Next War, build clone armies and mechanized units in futuristic scenarios set in the 2050s.
Giant death robots?
You beat me to it.
Yeah, that's probably what we saw in the front of the box.
Yep. Woohoo. Oh, and there's another scenario that sounds pretty exciting to me. Crossroads of the World. Carve your fortune from the riches of 14th century Africa, Arabia, and Persia as you trade, betray, and battle your way towards ruling the crossroads of the world. That sounds like a pretty exciting, interesting topic.
Sounds like something different.
It's not something that's been covered before. So anyone in particular you're looking forward to?
Which one's the easiest?
The world builder one.
Yeah.
The one with giant death robots appeals to me more than anything.
I guess I look at the list, and the only one that really doesn't excite me terribly is the World War II one, simply because we have quite a few World War-themed scenarios. Not anything against it, but I like the variety that we're getting here.
Yeah, that's true. I personally prefer historic scenarios. All the futuristic stuff and the fantasy stuff is not really for me, but there's something for everyone here, so that's good.
Yeah, I think I already said last time I was looking forward to Final Frontier. I know, I'm a space addict.
Well, Mackie, you're into sci-fi too? Dreamy.
Oh dear.
Key!
So, what about this historical Canada thing?
Historical Canada?
Oh, Dan.
Dan.
We have a few Canadians on the forum, I'm sure. One or two of them might even still have Civ 3 installed.
I highly doubt it. Didn't everyone burn the CDs today Civ 4 came out?
Yeah, so this is Episode 1, The New World. Canada, it's supposed to be the first of 3 episodes over...
Is there enough history in Canada to fill out the whole 3?
Is there enough history to fill up even 1?
This first episode here, again, historycanada.com, it's a 89 megabyte download. You need Civilization 3 Complete or Civilization 3 Conquest with the 1.22 patch. The time frame is New France, 1525 to 1763. I'd never heard of this company before, this media and gaming company, Bitcasters. Development for this mod pack was sponsored by the Canadian government and Canada's two national history foundations. Covers 400 years of Canadian history, original soundtrack, and hundreds of original art assets. They spent 2 years in development on this specifically, and $1 million.
2 years? They could have made it for Civ 4 then. Why on earth did they pick Civ 3?
The reason they went with Civilization 3 as opposed to Civilization 4, since this is geared towards history teachers and students of history in high schools, considering what the computers can run, Arts Technica, one of the articles I found that talks about this, linked through Google News, talking about how this has been 10 years in the making. The person who wrote this article said that in this case, the 10-year development period includes the conceptualization and planning of the project for educational purposes, not just the straight development of the game extension itself.
Okay, that makes sense. Although it's kind of sad if school computers can't even run Civ 4. At least at the lower settings, it should be possible. It
depends on where. In a not as affluent school district, they're not going to have up-to-the-date computers. And even in nicer places like where I grew up, they were still a year or two behind what I might have at home.
2K Games has also said that they are donating 100,000 copies of Civilization 3 to go with the mod pack, and perhaps that was an easier arrangement to make than to get 100,000 copies of Civ 4.
Yeah, they just want to get rid of the stock.
And it's great PR for them.
Yep.
What's going to happen with these 100,000 copies is 20,000 are going to be sent directly to high schools. Quote, where teachers will be able to use it in extra credit assignments and otherwise experiment with the game in the classroom, unquote. Yes, so any consideration of including it in the curriculum, of which there is a different history curriculum in every province in this country. And then the remaining 80,000 copies will be distributed, this is interesting, directly to 12 to 18-year-old students through mail or retail outlets, likely by an as-of-yet undetermined sponsor.
They mention the undetermined sponsor elsewhere, or someone asks about one of the other two volumes coming out, and they say, well, not until we find this yet undetermined business partner.
There were some earlier versions of the game that included the Iroquois Civ. They've been replaced by the Mohawk. As someone asked, I kid you not, desert is impassable, so there is no way for an attack to occur against an old world city. The response was, yes, that is correct. We did that to make sure that the old world was not destroyed rather than attempting to settle the new world. Who would do that? On the Mac version, just isn't the resources to produce a tested Mac version themselves, but Cal Burgess has kind of put out an open call. If someone gets a Mac version working, please let them know and they'll help make it publicly available.
So they have $1 million spent on this mod, which
yeah.
is, well, $1 million more than is spent on almost any other mod anywhere, and yet they can't convert it for a mod for Mac.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was kind of surprised by that. Somebody do it for free. It does work with the downloadable version of Civ 3 from Steam. And as I said, the two other versions, taking players to the year 1896 through Confederation and the expansion of the West. So expansion of the West, that's into the early 20th century.
So these people got paid $1 million to make a mod. I must be doing something wrong.
Yeah, where can we get that gig?
Yeah, but it's Canadian, but it's about 20 euros, I think.
And that's true, that's true.
I don't know. Wasn't there a thread in the off topic about how Canadian money and U.S. dollars are now one to one?
Yeah, so that's about 20 euros then.
Although at the time this was in development, the exchange rate was not so favorable.
So it's 21 euros?
The next topic is the Game Flood mod and map contest.
So I guess the first thing we need to tell Game Flood, Civilization is a turn-based strategy game. Did you know that? Since they've said they're going to place Civilization 4 and the Warlords expansion listed separately under the real-time strategy category. Just rename it strategy. Come on now.
And most people don't understand the difference anyway. Only nerds like us.
So I guess you can win up to $25,000 in cash. Well, I'm going to rephrase that. There's $25,000 in cash and keyboards.
Yeah,
interesting combination.
That's a lot of keyboards.
First-person shooter and role-playing game categories. There's some older RTS titles on this list of 15, I noticed. Wow, like StarCraft.
There's a list?
There's a list, yes.
Could you leave that for us? Please say thanks.
Yeah, I suspect there are probably more people who play StarCraft and StarCraft Brood War right now than play many of the other games on that list.
Yeah, and there's also yet another older game, Command & Conquer, Tiberian Sun. Wow, both 20th century games. Woo. Other notable strategy titles, Age of Empires 3 War Chiefs and Warcraft 3. Definitely the first-person shooter category is the largest with 21 titles, including Half-Life 2 and Doom 3. The RPG is the smallest category with only 4 eligible titles. They're looking for people to submit and to nominate and recommend their favorite mods and maps, although it should be noted that If, for example, you are the creator of a map or mod and it is nominated, you can request that you not be included in the competition, although I don't know why you would do that necessarily.
Yeah, some people have too much money.
Yes, if I win $3,000, I'll go into the next highest income bracket, and that's more taxes for me, so like no.
All the keyboards you could ever want.
All the more to throw out the window when your computer stops working.
Absolutely, mine take a bit of abuse, except I'll go and get another one, I've broken this one. It's usually when Montezuma declares war, we say, yeah!
Or Isabella stops returning your contact requests. Talk to me!
She's going to talk to you. She's going to talk to you with some conquistadors.
Community voting is from the 2nd to the 16th of July, so it doesn't actually say when nominations are closed, at least I didn't catch it. So obviously before the 2nd to the 16th of July, I would assume, but you know. First phase of the judging, where Game Flood members' downloads and approval ratings will provide the basis for the evaluations. And on the 27th of July, we will find out who won.
27th, you said?
Yep.
So pretty much when Beyond the Sword comes out. Good, we'll have a lot of attention for that then. We won't be occupied at all.
Nope. Dude, what? Contest? Where?
Only content released or updated since January 1st of 2006 is eligible.
I guess if you have StarCraft in the list of eligible games. I was released in 1965 or something like that.
No.
Got news? Email news at apolton.net or send a private message to Dan Q, Locutus, Illuminatus, Snoopy369, or Grand Patrol via Polton's forums at apolton.net/forums.
It's the modcast time?
Yep.
Yay!
And welcome to the Modcast, where we talk about various hot topics on all the different forums that talk about Civ.
Monk Spider had a post in the Civ4 General forum, basically suggesting that a lot of the features that Beyond the Sword adds, or has been announced to add anyhow, are not consistent with how Sorin's original vision of Civ4, which Sorin's original vision of Civ4, if those of you who are not familiar with this, originally and designed most of Civ 3. He stepped in after the first Civ 3 team basically all left, and ended up not making really the game he wanted, largely because he didn't know as much about Civ as he thought he did. There's a lot of interviews with him talking about the designing of Civ 4 where he describes this, and then basically after Civ 3 was finished and he realized, you know, this isn't really exactly what I wanted, he sat down and made a much simpler, more streamlined game in Civ 4, which had a lot of the stuff in Civ 3 that made it sort of a little more messy, like the corruption model and the pollution and things like that. A lot of that stuff, he basically just said, okay, we're going to start out and make this a lot simpler. And Monk Spider here suggests that basically Beyond the Sword adds in a lot of that other stuff that he took out and makes it a lot more complicated again. Whether you agree with that or not, that's sort of his point. He adds a lot more units that Civ 4 had a lot simpler units. So he's suggesting with corporations, it's allowing you to run around to avoid the whole resource scarcity problem. Which, honestly, I always thought that Civ 4 really didn't have as bad a resource scarcity problem as Civ 3 did, but...
Oh, I agree there.
Maybe I remember a different implementation of Conquest. but anyhow, I guess I don't really agree with that. I tend to think that Sorin's vision is a lot more complex than just a simpler game. If you want that simpler game, you can always play it. That's what Civ 4 Vanilla is. Civ 4 Vanilla is a very nicely organized, designed, concrete game. So the whole point of expansion packs is to add more. That's why there are still Civ 4 Vanilla PTBS games that are forming. And that's great, and there are going to be a lot of people who just like Civ 4 Vanilla. But then you add Beyond the Sword, and with Warlord, you add more stuff for the people who like that more stuff. And there's a lot of people, if you remember back in Civ 3 days, there was a lot of people who played, I don't remember the name of the mod, but there was the mod that basically tripled the amount of stuff that was in Civ 3, which already was a whole lot. That's sort of the point of the mods, and sort of the point of the expansion packs, is to add that more stuff for the people who like it. People who want a more complicated, whatever, espionage system, whatever, you know. If you don't like it, don't play it.
Yeah.
And I always had the impression that he simplified it down also, so at the same time you could build certain select things back up into the game and make it more complex, but not necessarily the overkill that you kind of got with Civ 3 and with some mods.
Exactly. I think that's really the point here. Monk Spider explains about espionage, that was something Sora never intended, but that's simply not true. He did always intend to have a more complex espionage system, maybe not as overpowered as in Civ 2, but he did always intend to have a more complicated system that ended up being in the game, but You know, as in pretty much any game, eventually you run out of time and you have to make some decision. And well, it just never really got around to making a truly, truly good espionage system. And that's what's being added in Beyond the Sword. Or in theory, anyway. We'll have to know how it works out. The late game is tending to becoming a bit top-heavy. If it's really overboard, I don't know. But he has a little bit of a point. There's a lot of new units, a lot of new stuff in the late game. Monsk Spider might have a little bit of a point there, but for the most part, I agree with Snoopy. Science fiction is a lot more than just simplifying the game. It's more making it easier to play and get rid of annoying things like pollution, whack-a-mole stuff from Civ 2, and other unpleasant concepts.
I honestly don't really understand the complaint about too many units, just because you don't have to build them. It's not like he's building units you have to build. You know, you don't have to build a paratrooper, and more options is always better. Like Sid said, strategy game is only a strategy game if you have a choice. If there's one right way to play it, it's not strategy.
There's a point, and there's choice, and there's just too much choice. At some point, it just becomes trivial. It's about interesting decisions, interesting choices. If you have 20 units to choose from, that's not really an interesting choice. It's much more interesting to have 3 or 4 units to choose from. I don't think Beyond the Sword really pushes the limit. It goes beyond the limit.
Yeah, but there's...
But it is getting near there. I don't think a third expansion that adds a lot of stuff would really work.
Yeah, we've typically not had that many expansions, but I don't know. Having more units, I think, particularly because there are so many different ways to play Civ. In the late game, you have the people who play very naval games, and you build a lot of marines and things like that. You have people who play a lot of just massive land invasions. And I think that having all those different ways of playing means that you don't just have 3 or 4 units to choose from. You have to have that 20 or so different units to choose from so that all those different play styles can all have a couple of interesting ways to play instead of the only way to play a water invasion is just to have marines. That's not really a strategic decision. You know, the decision was to make a marine invasion, but having a couple of different units you can use on that means a little more interesting.
Yeah.
Well, in my opinion, the proof will be in the pudding, and I mean, it depends on what they do. They look more like they're designed to make the later age a little bit more exciting, and some of the tweaks earlier on in the game, which I don't think sounds like a problem to me. The late game can be pretty slow.
Yeah, there's that zone there right after you get into industrial, but before you start hitting the modern age, you're kind of like, bored now.
Exactly. That's exactly it. To have the fleshing out that kind of era a bit more, that's fine. I think that's quite a good idea.
Oh, come on. There's plenty to do in the late game. You build the United Nations, and then you get the global resolutions for adopting the civics, and then even after it passes the first time, you propose it again just to see how the votes change? That's interesting.
For Dan, maybe.
Or you find the guy who built the UN and raise his city.
I'm liking that option.
More my preference? I don't know. Stupid anti-nuclear proliferation.
So maybe that kind of plays into the next topic. What bothers you about Civ 4?
Yeah, I'm reading that post, and I don't know. I don't know how much this guy plays this game, but I don't know. He has culture mongers and economongers. I don't know how often I've ever played Great Merchant strategy, but it certainly wouldn't go along with using great merchants to get you techs. I mean, his thing about specialist light bulbing technologies being a problem. A couple strategies that involved going for specific techs, specifically ignoring certain techs, and Warlords fixed that to a large extent, I think. But they don't really do that too often unless I'm way behind.
So what this thread suggested to me is that some people, they know the history, they know how history works, but sometimes they fail to remember that if you try and be too historically accurate and manage everything to historical precision, it ends up being a pretty crap game, usually. And I think there needs to be a certain amount of artistic license there. If you do everything like history, it'd end up pretty rubbish.
Yeah. A lot of the questions, you want to go for something that's better gameplay, or do you want to go for something that's more historically accurate?
And exactly.
I don't know about you, but I want something that plays better.
Yeah, Civ is more about alternate history, not strict history by the way it happened.
Yeah. Yep.
Although I have to agree with this person who said, why can't caravels carry settlers?
I was just going to say that.
It's balance, isn't it?
If caravels carried settlers, and that would make a very, very big balance issue. Yeah,
yeah.
There's no way, because then, you know, anybody who plays on archipelago maps where there's not galley contact available, that's the whole point. And it's the whole point of the Terra game, the Terra map, which not very many people play with, I don't think, but the whole point of that is you have this other continent that you can go build in once you get to astronomy, but you have to get to astronomy first. You have to be able to actually build galleons in order to get over there. If you make Caravel's area able to carry settlers, then...
A bit rubbish as well, having two very separated areas where you can't trade between one and the other, unless, of course, they change the prerequisite technology to optics.
Yeah.
Don't worry, Mackie. We'll find a modder where we're appreciated. We'll get what we want.
No. I can mod that for you guys real easy if you want. But anyhow, I have to say, a lot of the posts in this thread look to me like they're just balance issues. Like, they're just, you know, why is there a limit on the number of spies and missionaries? Well, because otherwise there would be, you could have some serious balance issues where you end up, you know, it ends up making religion way too powerful, or it ends up making, well, can't actually get out of my mouth the words espionage is too powerful, but if I imagine having a spy sitting in every single city just can know what everyone was doing, that would take away the whole point of spreading your religion around, for example. A lot of these issues are just balance issues, and that's exactly why it is that way.
Which are the most and least important Civilization IV resources of them all?
It depends on when, depends on the era, depends on what you want to do, it's so subjective.
Depends on whether it's multiplayer or not.
Yeah, I'll read his list off real fast. His number one was iron. His number two, oil. Number three, stone. Then his number four are the major food resources, rice, wheat, deer, corn, pig, which I guess is 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. number five, and marble, silver, fur, and gold, which I don't, I'll comment on them later. His number six is horse. Number seven is crabs. Number eight is ivory. And then the plantation stuff, so sugar and bananas and stuff like that. And then aluminum, and then uranium, and then whale. Copper, I have to say, not being on there sort of surprised me. But to me, number one and 1A, so one and two are probably iron and copper. And then number three is horses. His horse is essentially number nine or something. I don't see it being that low. To me, if you've got horses, then you can do a lot of stuff. And honestly, iron, copper, and horse, if you've got one of those three, then you're fine. If you have none of those three, you're toast. Probably after that, it would be cow and then corn. I definitely don't see cow being lower than corn, because cow gives you a 4-2. And if it's on grassland, you know, it's a 4-2 tile, which is really good. And it's much better than a 5-0 tile, because it's a lot more versatile. And then probably after that would be stone and marble. Either one of those would be quite useful. Gives you that flexibility to build some wonders. And then after that, to me, would be the silver, fur, gold, sort of the generic happiness resources. After that, probably some other food resources. Probably want two or three other food resources eventually. Probably have ivory bat where he does. They're sort of nice, but I'd rather have a stack of catapults than a stack of elephants any day. And then probably aluminum and oil after that. I consider aluminum and oil I'm going to get no matter what, because they're going to be somewhere on the map. I don't care if they're in my particular area. If I see aluminum and oil, if I don't have them, then I'm going to go find them. The same with coal. Coal is probably more important than either one, because I can build railroads at least. And then
the elusive whale.
Definitely whale on the bottom. I don't think I ever use a whale. It takes too long to be allowed to use the whale.
By the time you get it, it's a very short window.
Yeah, more so than anything else. I have to have, I think, optics, right? That said, I do like the little abysmal little tundra towns. I get enough of those normal player games. That...
Oh, now bronze and iron's an interesting one. Bronze is very good, I think, if you get it early. But if you don't have it and you have iron, I don't find bronze of that much use if you've got iron. But it's great if you can get bronze on bronze work and hook it up quickly.
And I think he's undervaluing horses a bit, because we all know that chariot rushes can do a lot of damage.
Well, and especially in chariots now, with warlords making chariots have a bonus against axemen. I think that was the problem before. That was the problem in vanilla, where horses weren't that useful, because if you didn't have copper or iron, someone would just axemen rush you every time and just destroy you.
Yeah, they finally have a proper counter for the axe.
I do like stone and marble. They come in handy for building wonders. I'm sure everyone agrees on that.
Yep.
And at the other end, of course, there's whales. I've got nothing against whales. You just never bloody see them. I mean, it's... Oh, what's that?
Or it's not worth moving your city one tile over just to get the whale.
Oh, you see, I could build a city in the middle of the Arctic to pick up a whale. Wonderful. For one or two happiness, which you don't need by that point anyway, usually, so...
Yeah.
I'm thinking he must be playing on lower levels to not value the plantation stuff as much. Because there are some maps where you have health problems.
Yeah.
And you really need the bananas and the spices and the sugar and everything else.
And then there's incense if you've got multiple cathedrals as well.
Yep.
Incense can generate one hell of a lot of happiness.
I find the most useful, and I actually broke it up to a most useful and a least useful. But yeah, iron and copper, I was really surprised as well, with everyone else not to see copper on the list, because that is a decent iron substitute, though. If it were not needing iron offensively for the swordsman and pikeman for defense, I would have probably ranked those two pretty well evenly. After that, number three, gold, gem, silver. You want to help prevent an early economic collapse. You can see the dye and the incense and then the silk, spices, and sugars you were saying on certain map types with the health considerations. But with the gold, gems, and the silver, there's no need to wait to be able to cultivate them. Oil, I put for number four, just as a later game lifesaver. Although, of course, iron and copper have got to be the early game lifesaver, because if you don't have those, then who cares about the later game? But oil, you will be in considerable trouble in defense of your skies and softening up defenders in the later game and going on the offensive. I would place Uranium here, but particularly in kind of a water heavier or heaviest maps. This original poster here thinks Uranium is too easily countered, but like Mango, I think he's focusing too much on ICBMs being knocked out, because Uranium is a substitute for oil and being able to build modern naval units.
Which is quite interesting, because you can even use it before you've discovered fission.
You'd like to play with glowy rocks.
I was about to say, it's also very shiny. And I'd put stone, and just a half level kind of below that in the ranking would be marble, again, as I've already been saying, in the builder resource consideration. And yeah, I would agree with everyone. I was really surprised in how low he put horses. The opening poster says, you general either love or don't care for this resource, especially on larger maps, but not even necessarily. Once you hit knight, and then particularly cavalry, I don't think any land unit is matched, let alone bested, in both strength and speed, best combination, until the tank. But also, horse are great pillagers.
Nice to send a cavalry stack in and just pillages. You know, by that point it became towns, presumably.
You seriously crippled his economy.
He's done for the game, pretty much, at that point, yeah.
Number 7, coal. Ironclads, blah. But railroads, oh yeah. I put aluminum at number 8.
Hello, spaceship.
Number 9, pigs and fish, just for the food yield. And they're also known at the outset of the game and cultivatable early on. And then in 10, I put, almost all of these start with C. Clam, corn, cow, crab, sheep, also known pretty well at the outset of the game and cultivatable early on, but just not as high food yield. As for the least useful, guess what number 1 on my list is? Well, surprise. banana at number 5 and sugar at number 4. But I think part of that's, again, dependent on the map type, especially with the sugar. I'm a Stonehenge person, and then Oracle. I put incense at number 3. Is it true that incense is only in deserts? I've only ever seen it in deserts.
I think so.
I put furs at number 2 in terms of being the least useful, as those are only near the polar regions, and they also go obsolete right now. But with incense being number 3, I would have almost combined fur and incense, except that being in deserts, desert is more likely to be surrounded by more useful terrain, and it also doesn't become obsolete.
Blood planes, anyone? I have to say, incense is more useful than that in harder games. In an Emperor game or even a Monarch game, you have that incense and you have 2 or 3 cathedrals, that +4 or whatever happiness you get from it is really quite useful.
I guess one of the final interesting points, and I hadn't even considered this in the consideration of the most and least useful resources, is Steve the Noble brings up the hit musicals, movies, and singles, and Joe, you'd kind of alluded to those when we were talking about to get mass media and radio. Except Steve the Noble poo-poos these, and he put them essentially on his least favorite list. I wouldn't put them on either list as either a least useful or most useful. Despite needing a great wonder to obtain, and therefore you restrict the availability, if you're on the larger maps, it appears in the later game, I think it'd be really maximized. You can export it, the extras, to other civs for considerable gold per turn, or perhaps by that point, they've got some later game resources that you don't have.
Or happiness resources you didn't get.
Exactly, that they wouldn't even consider trading to you, except even if they did, for something exorbitant.
Right.
Research Lab.
Research Lab.
Also known as the Lab of Research.
I feel like a scientist.
Welcome to the Research Lab, where we explore game concepts or ideas that are not in civilization yet, but they might be in the future.
So moving on from resources, the next topic is quantitative resources.
Yeah, which I read into this topic and I went, oh, headache of micromanagement.
I was about to say, did everybody love the long posts in this one?
Yeah, and definitely, I mean, this is one of those Sorin things. It goes back to that Sorin's vision. Sorin's vision was that it is not a headache of micromanagement. That was the number one point of the vision. Quantitative resources are, you know, they're realistic, and there's certainly some strategy games that use them. But I don't know. I mean, I think that, you know, it would be nice to have some benefit from them, but I don't think having, for every iron you have, that's an extra shard. Not only does that discourage people from trading the resources away, which that's, you know, a good part of the economy in Civ 4 is that trading resources. And if you have a reason not to do it, it's already enough reason not to do it, which is you don't want other people to be building swordsmen, you know, adding yet that other reason, you know, and just the unbalancing factor. Can you imagine if I have 10 iron in the game and there's 7 players, start with 4 of them, you know, I can build my swordsmen that much faster, and also there's my neighbor next to me who doesn't have any iron. That's just massive unbalancing factor. That iron already is pretty big unbalancing factor, you know, making it even worse is just not a good idea.
I mean, the thing is, are these people asking for a game where they have resources which are quantitative, so they can produce X amount of this resource per turn, and maybe have a plant that can create 50% extra of a refined resource and sell it on or use it. But there's already a game called Colonization which does that anyway. So if people want to go down that route of that micromanagement, there's a game for them.
Yeah, and resource management like that, it's starting to sound like StarCraft at the same time too, or Warcraft.
Yeah, and indeed the person who started this thread, Gaius Octavius, says a model similar to what's in Colonization is probably the way to go, so he says.
I could see it being interesting for a scenario if you wanted to have something like set in the ancient world and you managed to get some iron first, that kind of a thing. But for the base game, no. It sounds like too much of a micromanagement headache.
The other issue with it from the balance point of view is if you're going to have this advantage from having several resources, you're going to have more resources. How often do you really have two irons or two horses? You don't even really have it all that often. So it would make it sort of this minor feature that just if someone happens to luckily get a couple of one resource, they get a huge advantage and just win the game easily. You know, you'd have to have a whole lot of horses and a whole lot of irons so that everybody had two or three or four, at which point starts becoming, well, okay, then you can't really have a significant tile advantage from a tile with iron or horses anymore. You start going into all those balance issues where you have to have a bunch of horses, but then the horses can't give you two or three extra hammers. They can only give you one extra hammer or something like that. The balance issues just would be insane, I think.
However, if these guys want to make a colonization mod, we'd be happy to see it.
And this is from Verbrenier's. The bottom line is he thinks this is a great idea and is desperately needed, but keep it simple and don't be afraid to use broad brush strokes. The rest of the game does, and it works beautifully as a result. One of the biggest things that seemed to come out of it is some person raised the concern of there are almost 40 different resources in Civ 4. As it stands now, the player has to keep track of their treasury, their research rate. Imagine the kind of player who would enjoy keeping track. Ooh, maybe we can get a little bit of spreadsheet action going on there.
Yay, spreadsheet.
A user, WW2Commander, said perhaps the best thing is to have a hybrid system where quantitative resources only applies to strategic resources, not food or luxuries. If you are going to implement this hybrid system, just how are you going to do that? And I guess the other big consideration is, will the AI know how to use the system? Obviously, if you're mostly a multiplayer person, you don't care, but...
Yeah, I don't know. Try to teach the AI to do that. You've not seen good results.
Wow. It's true.
Yeah, we got mail.
And it wasn't spam.
That was the other surprise.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-659, 301-637-POLY.
And for Europe, 44-020-7871-7659, 44-020-7871-POLY.
Or you can Skype us at the Polycast.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on the show, including how to write in and how to subscribe to the RSS feed, log on to the official Polycast website at polycast.apolton.net.
Type more quietly.
Yeah,
damn.
Seriously.
That is nasty.
That's what my freaking keyboard makes, damn it. Shall we move on, I guess, to the Senate?
Not the real Senate, but our Senate. Oh, right, that's politics. Oh. Sorry.
Welcome to the Senate. In this section, we talk about game strategy.
So, great general.
Two threads on this, one back in April, where user SM Baker-esque asked what other Civ 4 players have been doing with their great generals. And then late last month, Grand Patrol asked the same similar question. So what does everyone do with their GGs?
I pretty much make a constructor, so unless I'm in need of having a level 3 or level 4 unit. But most of the time, if I've got a great general, I probably have already got a level 3 or level 4 unit to get that heroic epic. But I mostly just try to make a constructor, my first couple, because I tend to go for the more unit spam type. I usually have plenty of money, so I just build lots and lots of units and... having those 5 experience points units to start out with.
Yeah, it's usually a lot easier with me. I'll use that first one on a unit, and then I'll use him to get up to the higher levels that you need for, like, West Point and the Pentagon, so I can have that later.
One of the things I try and get as well is if you have a stack that's knocking down a lot of cities, is to have a Medic 3 with them. If a lot of units take a lot of damage, you can recover them very quickly and start moving on again.
Yeah, the best thing to do is indeed to use them for extra experience for new units. But I usually use the first couple to attach them to units just because it's fun.
Well, how do you think I get that guy up to the level where I can get the Pentagon? That's what the first guy does.
Yeah, but maybe one is good to have to attach your unit for the experience. But beyond the first one, you don't really need great generals. But they are a lot of fun to play with, so that's usually what I do.
Yes, there have been some threads in the past where people have had units with staggering amounts of experience. Hundreds upon hundreds of points. It looks like the entire unit on its own must have conducted several wars and probably a few reloads as well in there, I strongly suspect.
Yeah, kind of. That's really sucks if you have a 200 XP unit and you actually lose it.
Exactly, so hence you get these stupid amounts of experience. It must have started off as a chariot long in the distant past, another a helicopter.
Usually you lose a great general event. I mean, I guess maybe you should do reloads, but even at a 95% rate in 20 combats, you're still going to lose one. But it's just silly to only use your great general on 99%+ combats, because then what's the point of having him in the first place? What's a 99% chance for my warlord or regular mason can win most of the time anyway?
Well, that's it. I generally tend to have one unit like that that's there to heal rather than do much fighting.
Well, yeah.
I myself have never used a GG to upgrade unit to a warlord. Pretty well go for military academies earlier on in the game for the +25% bonus to military unit production. Although if I get a great general later on in the game, I might be interested to have them join the city as a great military instructor.
Mm.
But before then, if I want the +2 experience unit points, I'd just beeline for feudalism for the vassalage legal civic.
I've actually never built an academy, because 25% just isn't worth it when you're compared to all the other. It's not cumulative. I mean, it's not multiplicative. It's just additive, so if you're running bureaucracy and you've got a heroic epic out there and you've got a forge and whatnot, it's like three extra hammers.
Ooh, three hammers.
That's not really worth all that much when I'm producing 30 or 40 hammers. The +2 experience to me is worth a lot more, and not having to run vassalage. I mean, I never run vassalage, you know, because I'd rather be running, I don't know what I'd rather be running, but I'd rather be running something more useful than vassalage. Because, I mean, that's all it does. It's not really that useful, you know, unless you're having money problems.
Yeah, well, after the availability of factories and power plants, the allure of military academies diminishes enough for me that I'll switch to having them join as a great military instructor. Also, if I only fail to be the first to build the Pentagon wonder, that's always nice.
Comes in handy.
Yeah.
The other interesting thing about military instructors built into your city are they get the benefits of representation and of the Sistine Chapel as well.
Right.
It's a little thing, but it's another incentive to build them in.
The next one is Nowhere to Run in the early game.
I don't know if anybody ever saw this thread by Dauphin, which he posted a few weeks ago, where he automatically positioned within a few squares of another neighbour, and he moved up, and he was on a peninsula blocked off by a mountain. You could only build one city.
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
I've seen it in MP.
Yeah, that's happened in Raw's Saturday Night Game a couple of times.
Who was it? Was it DD that got that last time,
yeah,
I think? He was Persia, but he was blocked off, and he could...
Yeah. But that usually happens because the map only has a certain number of starting points.
Yeah.
You know, it has certain spaces that it considers an acceptable spot for a starting point. If you only have 5 of them on that map and you have 6 players, well, that's going to happen. One of the players is going to get stuck next to another one of them.
It also tends to happen when you have a smaller map.
Mm-hmm.
If you set it to a high sea level, so you have a very small land mass.
Right. Yeah, that happens a lot on Pangaea, I've noticed, as opposed to if you play something like Ring or Inland Sea and things like that. There's a lot of really good map types out there, and the different map designers spent a lot of time making some very interesting map types.
Like Oasis.
I got a contemptuous hmm. Hmm. Oasis, eh?
Cordelian asks, are there any other stories where the start has really left nowhere to expand? Do a custom game, dual size map, 18 civs. Oh, yeah.
Oh, I've done that.
That's wicked.
That's ridiculous.
That's a game where you better pick a civ that has a warrior to start out with. If you're one of those scout civs, you're toast.
The next is tips for a culture victory. Although, again, I have to reiterate what I said in the last episode. Who wins a culture victory? What?
I like cultural victories sometimes. It's actually a fairly hard one if you're playing at an appropriate difficulty level. It's actually fairly hard. Anything a monarch or above is fairly difficult to get. But it's quite a good challenge, especially when you know you're not going to win by space. As long as you can beeline for radio.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's the big one. Beeline to the radio and mass media. getting those three wonders in the Eiffel Tower particularly are very important for that. I think the keys to me, I think there are one, build as many religions as possible, either get them yourself or get other people to give them to you. Because you really need six or seven religions in your cities. Nine cities is fine because your three core cities all need to have cathedrals on them for as many different religions as possible. And if you can get six or seven cathedrals in your cities, that's an insane amount of culture right there. Plus each one of the cities, except maybe your capital probably has enough culture by itself,
yeah.
But the other two cities should have the Hollywood and whatnot. They have to be reasonably productive cities because by the end, when you're at maybe 30,000 cultures, 20 or 30,000 culture, you're going to be running just culture 100%. And
yeah.
Producing culture also yeah. with your instead of your hammer.
That's what usually helps me over the top.
Yeah, you can get 800, 900, 1,000 plus per turn easily by the end.
That's quite a bit.
Great artists. A lot of people try to use great artists for the 4,000 or depending on what map size and speed you're playing on, whatever culture. But it actually, unless you're very, very late in the game, make sure and don't do that. Instead, settle them because when it's multiplied by that, 400-500% multiplication, actually gives you quite a bit more over the long run, unless you're in the last 20 or 30 turns or so.
Yeah, I've got that going into PBM right now, where it's too late in the game for me to settle them, because I get less than the 4,000 I would get just for using them to create the great work.
Right.
So.
And there was K. Mad Candy in the thread. He's holding on to a number of his great artists for a later game culture bomb. He says, quote, "I'm refusing to even learn chemistry so that Parthenon doesn't go obsolete." Wow.
That's not an entirely uncommon strategy. I've seen a few people in other games who are refusing to learn chemistry for that very reason. They're really going after the great whatevers. Though by reasonably late in the game, you ought to be able to get enough other multipliers that it's not that big of a deal.
What's the, I don't recognize your tanks. I have the Parthenon. Uh-oh. What type of victory, assuming you win, do most people usually either end up going for or end up getting?
It depends a lot on the start. Culture victory, you sort of have to decide fairly early on, but it's fairly easy to see the kind of start that you need a couple of religions and you need three pretty good solid cities. If you've got those three pretty good solid cities and you've got a couple of early religions, then absolutely, that's a no-brainer for me. But Space Race is sort of the one that if you're getting late in the game and you're ahead of the AI a little bit in tech, then usually you can get that pretty easily as long as, again, you've got a decent-sized nation. And Domination is sort of default for me, I guess. It's that when nothing else, when I'm not going to get Culture and I'm not going to get Space Race and I don't have enough vassals to win the Diplomacy Race, Domination sort of, I'll build a whole bunch of tanks and go for it.
That's also what you do when you're stuck in that little corner of tundra or plains. There's no good cities around you. Time for conquest.
Oh, of course. Well, that's when you build a bunch of cherries and cherry rush for whoever's nearest early on.
Dominate.
Yeah.
Usually end up going for a space race myself. Just usually the fact that I'm a bit of a science whore, so to speak. So I like to accumulate technology to get myself ahead of the game.
I'm usually diplomatic or secondarily score in time, all tying into my typical builder strategy.
Now with warlords and with vassals, diplomatic doesn't really happen very often for me. Just because if I'm going to get diplomatic, I essentially need to with a bunch of vassals, because I tend to go for an early religion and tend to make people a little bit upset about that. And unless you get a whole bunch of people with your religion, the only way you're going to get it is by having a bunch of vassals, at which point you might as well go for domination anyway.
Yes. No one ever likes me enough to vote for me in a diplomatic victory, so I have an elite core of people who absolutely worship the ground I walk on, and the others go, not him. So I've never had a diplomatic victory.
Aww.
No one likes me.
I'll let you share one of mine.
So, what's a good city? I have to say, a good city for me usually is one with a whole bunch of floodplains. I'm definitely a floodplains guy. When I choose cities, Civs almost always pick a financial one. I love floodplains because not only can you get the great tech cities, which is usually what you do with them, but that one great person generating city, if you have four or five floodplains, then you just farm those, and then you basically have as many great people as you can possibly generate as quickly as possible, and especially if you can manage to get one or two plains hills or something that'll give you enough hammers to get a couple of wonders.
Yes, floodplains are very versatile. You can farm them to make a bunch of food and have that great person city, or you can plunk the cottages on them for a lot of gold, or even both in the same city, depending on how many you have. Floodplains and nice hills. Grasslands on a river are also nice.
Yeah.
I'm actually realizing, and I'd never really played with workshops before, But a Plains with a workshop on it, once you've passed guild, just as good as a Plains Hill. You can see that 0-4. Because I'd always sort of assumed that I wouldn't want to give up that food.
Yeah, I made the same discovery this week as well, incidentally.
Yeah, I noticed that especially before biology, it's a lot more useful that way, especially if you have a bunch of grassland on the other side or something.
Yeah.
But I think the only issue with that is going to be the health consequences of having quite a few workshops. If you do it all right for health, I don't suppose it's a big deal, but...
Yeah, I got plenty of health. Not usually a problem.
No, I very rarely had health problems. So I guess a good city is a versatile city.
I don't know. There tends to be a lot of specialization in cities. Some cities are better for pumping out wonders. Some cities are better for having a great leader. Some are better for science. Well, you'll end up with one that tends to have a military specialty, for example.
Right. Yeah. Heroic epic and whatnot.
But don't put your wonder city on the border.
No.
Yeah.
That's just like bait.
Politan University.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We do have that.
If people do want to learn how to play Civ better, there is a good way for competitive playing to have other people give you advice. That's the Politan University.
And we would find that where? Jeez.
Politan.net
really?
/ forums?
Wow, how could I figure that out?
I don't know.
Politan University. Sometimes I wonder. This is from Gaius Octavius. Outfitting an army, 5,000 gold. Building a navy, 3,800 hammers. Switching to police state and theocracy, 2 turns anarchy. Seeing the expression on Isabella's face when you invade her country with 500 tanks and 80 stealth bombers? Priceless. There are some things money can't buy. For everything else, there's Civ 4.
500 tanks. I don't know what the difficulty level he's playing on. You can get a stack of 500 tanks.
Or how big of a map was that? 500 tanks.
Yeah. Still say I'd probably want to use my stack by the time it got to 100.
I think you'd have great them all.
Overkill. Although, oddly, I don't think the 80 stealth bombers is overkill.
No, not at all.
Not for Montezuma or Isabella. I think it's quite justified.
Hello.
Hello, that was my phone, I'm afraid. Hang on a second.
Okay. Yay.
Not a polycast without someone's phone ringing.
It's better than Imran's phone. Oh.
This is not vibrate.
Yeah. All right. Another polycast is in the can.
Are you suggesting we put it in the garbage? That's not fair.
No, I think that's what usually suggests.
Yeah.
Or
yeah, at least it's getting long.
Actually, I'm very disappointed hasn't necromanced any of our threads recently, or said how awful we are.
He's been busy necroing other threads. We miss you. Come harass us.
Who should do the outro? Unless Rich or Joe feel up to it, I nominate Mackie.
Please say you're up to it. Please say you're up to it.
Insert cricket sound here.
Thank you for joining us on Polycast number 17 this week. And I've been Provost Harrison, Richard Harrison, and the host has been Mr. Daniel Quick, Dan Q, Makalua, Joe, more commonly known as Snoopy369, and Wouter Schneiders, or Locutus, as we more commonly know him as.
Rich, was this as good or better than you remembered it from the last time?
It was... I can't remember the last time. It was good. It was good.
You blocked it from your mind. And Joe, do you like listening to the episode? Assuming you've listened to episodes.
No, it's not really like listening to the episode. Because the episode's usually a little bit more...
coherent?
Polished? Polished.
Not quite so much dead meat.
And you can't talk back at us either.
Well, you can.
Oh, I can talk back. You just can't hear.
You are still on, and you will remain on the guest co-host rotational. You never know when the next private message will come from me.
Don't answer it. Don't answer it.
Just when you thought it was safe to go back into the forum. To paraphrase that famous tagline.
Record date June 9th, 2007. Soundtrack courtesy Civilization 4 and its Warlords expansion pack. Stargate Atlantis Clips copyright MGM Global Holdings Incorporated.
Copyright 2007, Appleton Civilization site at appleton.net.